Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Most Americans, and I would hope all Americans, know the great names of Dwight D. Eisenhower, Douglas MacArthur, George Marshall, George Patton, important generals who were instrumental in the Allied victory in the Second World War. But even if we know those names and something about their importance, I think most of us do not begin to know sort of the road which each of them traveled to be the great, important, influential figures that they were during the Second World War. And that is why the book we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes is so incredibly important and beneficial. The book is titled Generals in the Making: How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II. It is easy in hindsight to view history as just one inevitable event after another, when in fact there is nothing inevitable about anything that occurs in our history, and that in many cases crucial events or the emergence of crucial figures can often be the subject of capricious chance, or it can be the result of a very important sort of outward or ancillary influences which we might not really understand or be aware of. Certainly, we, most of us at least, do not begin to understand the important growth that occurred with these figures in American military history in the years leading up to the Second World War. And this book, just published by Stackpole Books, is a very valuable resource for us understanding this story better. The author, Benjamin Runkle, is a proud Bronze Star recipient from Operation Iraqi Freedom. He has served in the Department of Defense, and he is currently a senior policy fellow with Artists International and an adjunct lecturer in Johns Hopkins University's Global Security Program. He is the author of Wanted, Dead or Alive, Manhunts from Geronimo to Bin Laden, and again the title of his latest book, Generals in the Making: How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II. Benjamin Runkle, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great to be here, Greg.
How long have you known that these stories of this earlier chapter, the sort of chapter between the world wars, that this was such an important period for Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur and so on? I mean, is this something that you, as someone who's been part of the military, has known for a long, long time? Or are you, in a sense, kind of a latecomer to this story as well?
I would have to say I'm honestly a latecomer to this story, that when I was a lieutenant in the 82nd Airborne, and we'd have days off, I used to sit on my balcony and read. And one day I was reading Henry Kissinger's Diplomacy, and I came across the fact for the first time that at the beginning of World War I in September 1939, the United States Army was only the 17th largest army in the world. I mean, think about that, 17th largest army in the world. That in size, that was right in between Bulgaria and Portugal. Today we spend as much on defense as the next seven countries combined. And so it got me to thinking, wondering, how did these officers, with so few training resources, with obsolete equipment, with skeletal forces, how did they develop from first lieutenants, captains, such as what I was surrounded with at Fort Bragg, how did they develop into what I consider to be the greatest generation of operational commanders in U.S. military history? And so it began sort of an ongoing fascination, an ongoing project for me. And I didn't realize how much influence their careers as junior officers and their personal lives as junior officers would end up having on their development as leaders and how they commanded in World War II.
I think it's really important for us to talk for a couple more minutes about, let's call it, the decline in stature and the evaporation of resources involving especially the United States Army in the years right after World War I, a development which occurred to the great consternation of General John J. Pershing and of course, others as well. Explain the factors that were involved that led to this rapid deterioration.
Well, it was multiple factors. It was first that the war was essentially sold as the war to end all wars, that it was this great crusade, this great conquest to make the world safe for democracy. And I think there was great disappointment back in the United States when the Versailles Treaty took hold, that it really ended up being exposed to Americans, in their view, as just another balance of power war and was a great disappointment. This was followed certainly in the late 1920s, by the Great Depression, when resources were actually very scarce. And so Army budgets shrank massively during that time period. The Army, the anti-militarism and isolationism started to grow as political philosophies in the United States, and people started to see, essentially, as Douglas MacArthur described it, they started to see war as a monstrous anachronism. So these factors ended up shrinking the Army from about 3.5 million during World War I back down to about 150,000 at its nadir between the wars.
One of the things that you tell us about is that the ramifications of this go beyond the obvious, and you spell out a number of ways in which this had far-reaching effects on the overall effectiveness of the U.S. Army. And one of them, which I'd never stopped to think about, involved promotions within the U.S. Army, or let's say the lack of promotions. I mean, or the fact
exactly.
that the pace of promotions slowed to a terrible crawl. Explain a little further what I'm talking about here and the significance of that.
Well, the Army was very traditionalist in those days, and they did promotion by a strict seniority system. Basically, first in at a rank would have the priority to be promoted. It wasn't a merit-based promotion system. And so as a consequence, you had what was called the hump, that a lot of officers volunteered to serve in World War I and then chose to stay in afterwards. So you had more officers, really, than you had positions eligible for officers. So promotions were very slow. Basically, people had to age out, retire, or die for slots to open up above. So as a consequence, talented officers like Dwight Eisenhower, he ended up being a major for 16 years. Joseph Lawton Collins spent 13 years. Lightning Joe Collins spent 13 years as a captain. And Maxwell Taylor, who commanded the 101st in World War II, was a first lieutenant for 13 years. So this is obviously not conducive to creating incentives for people to innovate, to try and be better officers, to learn more when the promotions are stagnated as badly as they are.
And so the U.S. Army most certainly lost what would have been very promising and very effective officers who eventually chose to leave because there was just no sense that there was going to be any worthwhile opportunity for advancement and would leave for the private sector.
Exactly. And also a lot of these officers during World War I, because civilians, college-educated civilians, became officers during World War I, they often had great connections back in the business world back home. And so they recruited a lot of talented junior officers in World War I to come back to their companies, to come back to their industrial concerns after the war. So there was an attrition even before times started to become bad, there was already starting to be an attrition of talented officers at the end of World War I.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Benjamin Runkel about his book, Generals in the Making, How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II. This book focuses on the years following the First World War, supposedly the war to end all wars, and talks about the ways in which America's most important military leaders in the Second World War manage to emerge and flourish and develop in this period between the two world wars, a circumstance or scenario which might at a glance be very unpromising as the training ground for great military leaders, and yet somehow it happened. And this book explores that in fascinating detail. We probably shouldn't spend too much time on this, but we should probably spend a little more time talking about General John J. Pershing, one of the great heroes of the First World War, who, of course, did not live long enough to play any kind of role whatsoever in the Second World War. He was gone by then. But he is an important figure, not only in the First World War, but in these years immediately following it. And in particular, there are years in which he is locked in something of an unhappy and tense rivalry with another general. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about and why this was so significant in terms of the direction that the U.S. Army ultimately took.
Well, he had a rivalry with General Peyton March, who's sort of lost to history. He was the chief of staff during the last year of World War I. And he was a logistical genius at being able to mobilize and deploy the forces from America to France, which the two previous chiefs of staff had failed miserably at. But he also thought the chief of staff, by virtue of his position, outranked the commander of the American Expeditionary Forces, which was Pershing, and thought, therefore, he should have more of a say on strategy and operations. And Pershing resented this very much. Pershing also recommended promotions for officers serving in France, which March denied. They just had different philosophies. March said, not everybody's getting to go to France. I mean, many prominent young officers, Eisenhower never got to deploy. Omar Bradley never got to deploy. Collins, Matthew Ridgway never got to deploy. And he said, by the sort of luck of the draw of who's getting to go versus those who are doing very important jobs back here in the United States, they shouldn't be prejudiced as far, or they shouldn't be advantaged in terms of promotion. So they had some disagreements there. The other big issue that came about, though, was the drawing up of the, what became the 1920 National Defense Act. And this was the act that was basically going to set U.S. military policy for the next 20 years. And Peyton March had a vision for a large 500,000-man standing force, which would have been more than five times larger than any American army in peacetime ever, and how that this should be a permanent force ready to be able to be a tool of American policy if need be. Pershing took a different stance, arguing that they should have a much smaller force that was training large numbers of reserves, large number of National Guard for a necessary someday mass mobilization. And so it came to a head when Pershing arrived back in America from France. Actually, this Sunday is the anniversary of when they departed from, when his entourage left France on September 1st, 1919. But so October 1919 was basically the hearings before Congress, and in the days before you had 24-hour news, before you had social media, this was a great sensation. What would Pershing say about the National Defense Act? What would his recommendation be? Because, as you said, he was the great hero, and he had such clout that this was going to be the persuasive, this would sway the most senators. And so he ended up taking a stance diametrically opposed to March. And this would determine, as I say, the course of American defense policy for the next 20 years.
This is a good time for us to touch on one of the giants of World War II, and even a giant beyond World War II, namely General George Marshall, who ended up being a very important aide under General Pershing. And you talk about how significant he was to General Pershing and how much he learned from him. But I wonder if you would just take a second to tell our listeners one of the most intriguing stories in the book, which is about what turns out to be a very kind of volatile exchange between the two of them. This is before George Marshall has become an aide to General Pershing. And one might think that an exchange such as occurred between them would have made it impossible for the two of them to have ever worked together as closely as they did. Explain to our listeners the exchange that I am talking about. It's a remarkable story.
No, exactly. And this is a story I didn't know when I began researching this book. So in October 1917, the U.S. Army is beginning to arrive in France. And the U.S. Army, before World War I, did not have any divisions that were organic units that worked and trained as divisions. So they took an amalgamation of forces. They called it the 1st Division. It's now the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. And they basically put it together on the fly, sent them to France, and to start training them there, rather than trying to train them as a division in the United States. Pershing was under extreme pressure from the British to just say, hey, if you guys are going to mobilize 3 million men, why don't you just stick them into our units who are already on the front lines? We need more manpower. You speak English. Why don't we just do it that way? And Pershing, for reasons of pride, and he was supported by President Wilson on this, was, no, we are going to have an American army. So therefore, in order to strengthen his arguments against the British plan for amalgamation, he needed operational units, units that were well-trained, that were ready to go. And so he took an inordinate amount of interest into the 1st Division's training. And it was rough to start out with. They once did a parade. Pershing brings the French president to watch the American forces parade, and it's a disaster. They're over a really choppy field. None of these men have been trained in close order drill. They've been training on tactical things, and it's an embarrassment. And Pershing excoriates the 1st Division's commander, Major General William Seibert. A month later, in October 1917, at Gagnecourt, France, the 1st Division is doing a demonstration of trench warfare tactics that Pershing comes to observe, and it's being led actually by Theodore Roosevelt Jr.'s battalion, the former president's son. They do their demonstration of trench warfare, and Pershing starts to ask some of the officers questions. William Seibert, Major General Seibert, was an engineer before the war and a very accomplished officer, but he didn't know a lot about infantry, and so his answers weren't very good. Pershing asks the next officer, the new chief of staff, who'd only arrived from the United States 2 days ago, 2 days beforehand, about the demonstration, and he doesn't have very good answers. Pershing had a temper. Pershing basically goes off on Major General Seibert in front of his entire staff, in front of all the soldiers, to talk about their incompetence, about the wasted time, etc. And then he turns to leave. A major on General Seibert's staff speaks up and says, sir, I think you're wrong. You're not giving him full enough credit. Pershing sort of waves him off. And then something that would be almost unthinkable, a young major basically reaches out and grabs Pershing by the shoulder, turns him around and says, no, sir, you have to listen to this. And he says, this is the reason why this is. This was, you never gave us in the platoon commander's guide that you were supposed to. We haven't received that. This is why they don't have nomenclature. Pershing says, well, asks an aide. They say they have problems with the French printers. And Pershing says, you must understand, we have our problems. And so the young major says, sir, we understand you have problems. We have problems, too, and they need to be solved every day, and goes into a litany of the supply problems, that they don't have enough shoes for men with large feet. They don't have enough billets so that men are sleeping in barns. The training grounds are miles away, so the men have to march 6 miles before they can even start training. And just sort of a litany of everything that's going wrong with the division to date. That's the fault of Pershing's headquarters. Pershing sort of grunts at him, walks away, and everybody says to George Marshall, who was the major, says, well, it was nice knowing you. Your career is over in the Army. But thereafter, every time Pershing came to visit 1st Division headquarters, he would pull Marshall aside and say, okay, tell me what's really going on. What's the scoop? That Pershing, rather than being offended, rather than taking umbrage at being told he was wrong, appreciated that there was someone who would tell him the truth of the matter, someone who would always give him an honest, unvarnished opinion. And so he consequently brought Marshall onto his staff as a planner, and then after the war, as one of his personal aides. And it became a protege-mentor relationship that was very important to the formation of the organizing of the Army, actually, in World War II.
It's just fascinating, and I love the way you tell the story, because the way it is told in your book, we do not know until the story is done that that young major was George Marshall. and then, of course, we read that name with amazement, because, you go on to explain how George Marshall ended up becoming an invaluable aide to General Pershing. And one of the things you tell us about the 5 years that George Marshall spent as an aide to General Pershing, you say Marshall's 5 years with Pershing enabled him to broaden his horizons immensely, reading the flow of paper in and out of Pershing's office. Marshall could observe the entire Army establishment. I don't think I would have stopped to realize that one of the greatest benefits of being an aide and doing all of the work that he did for General Pershing was that George Marshall would learn so much more about his beloved U.S. Army, something he already knew a lot about, but only from, in a sense, his own perspective, his own limited perspective.
Exactly that. A lot of emphasis gets placed in some World War II histories about whether someone had served in combat in World War I. And this is still a lot of the time the way we judge officers today. Did they serve in combat? That it gives them extra credibility on certain issues. But the reality is George Marshall never served in the trenches in any real form. He visited units, but he never actually served. He never served in a combat position. But because of his position with Pershing after the war, he read every board. When they convened all the boards for the lessons learned, he gained a broader perspective. He read the summaries of it. He read when they were debating reforming the personnel system. He read the personnel profiles of thousands of junior officers many of whom would eventually become his generals during World War II. They went on a tour because of the March-Pershing rivalry. In the winter of 1919-1920, they wanted to get Pershing out of Washington, D.C. because he and March were such a combustible pair. So Pershing was sent on an inspection tour of all U.S. military facilities, U.S. Army facilities, to determine which ones should be retained in the post-war era. And so consequently, Marshall got to actually see almost every Army installation. And so when it came time in 1939-1940 to start mobilizing for World War II, there, quite frankly, wasn't a single officer who knew more about the institutional Army than Marshall, and it was drawn largely from his experiences from 1919-1924 as Pershing's aide, which included also he accompanied Pershing for congressional hearings. He briefed senior senators. He briefed the president. So Marshall came into the position of chief of staff in 1939 with experience that was unique, that no other officer had, essentially, and it stemmed directly from his being in the shadow, or not in the shadow, but being the protege of Pershing when he was chief of staff of the Army.
Right. I want to mention two other matters of George Marshall. One of them is the tragic death of his wife Lily in 1927, and your book really explains how this was not only, of course, a personal tragedy for George Marshall, but also had tremendous professional significance for him, because this was, in a sense, part of what ultimately prompted him to leave Washington, D.C., and in doing so and taking his post at Fort Benning, that paved the way for all kinds of significant things which he did thereafter. And it is so interesting to think about how much of history, in a sense, turned on a personal moment in George Marshall's life that most of us do not know anything about.
No, exactly that. I mean, he was very much in love with, as he should be with his wife. It was funny when he met her at VMI as a cadet at VMI. He wasn't a great student, but he had a perfect discipline record. The most incredible self-discipline of very few people in history have had comparable self-discipline. But he fell in love with her. She lived just off post, and he would sneak out to go and basically court her, et cetera. He risked his military career to court his future wife. And so when she died very unexpectedly in 1927, he was devastated. You know, the portrait of Marshall that you get in most biographies or World War II histories of him is cold and austere. But when you see his correspondence in the wake of her death, that just his admissions to some friends, how lonely he was, his confiding to Pershing, who himself was a widow, who Pershing's wife and three daughters died in a horrible fire in 1915. You start to see a very different side of Marshall. And as I say in the book, and as you said, it had significant repercussions for the Army. At the time, he was just an instructor at the Army War College, it was a prestigious educational institution for the interwar Army, but it wasn't very significant. It was sort of seen as a year off, almost a year of sabbatical, just for them to do some studying. he couldn't bear to be around his apartment, their house that they lived in at Washington Barracks in Washington, D.C., and he had to get out to keep his sanity. So his friends arranged for him to become the assistant commandant of the infantry school at Fort Benning. And there he turned a revolution. He basically revolutionized the way the U.S. Army trained its infantry, far less doctrinaire, encouraged students to say, if you can innovate and come up with a better solution to a tactical problem than what we're teaching, let us know. Or as his friend and his assistant, Joseph Stilwell, who was an instructor at the school, said, let us know any screwball idea you have. And as a result of this innovative training about how they taught them to think on their feet, how they taught them to be much more improvisational in their leadership, it ended up producing 200 generals in World War II were students or instructors under him when he was at the infantry school from 1927 to 1932. And it literally does read like an all-star who's who's list.
Right.
So Bradley, Hodges, Collins, Ridgway, Manton, Eddy, Walter Bettel Smith. These were all products of Marshall's system of instruction.
Right. As you write, although success in war is the product of countless variables, seen and unseen, it can be plausibly argued that without Dwight Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, George Patton, Joe Collins, Matthew Ridgway, and a handful of other key Army and Corps commanders, America and its allies would not have been able to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. If so, then it could also be argued that since none of these men would have held their commands if not for George Marshall, either due to his direct intervention or because of his Herculean efforts to expand, train, and equip the Army on the eve of that conflict, victory would not have been possible without George Marshall.
And no less than, I mean, Harry Truman famously said, millions of Americans gave their service during the war. George Marshall gave us victory. Winston Churchill called him the organizer of victory in World War II. So there was a recognition that even though he did not hold the battlefield command, that his efforts were irreplaceable and were crucial to winning the war.
We're speaking with Benjamin Runkle about his book, Generals in the Making, How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II. You have fascinating insights into the development of Dwight D. Eisenhower as well as George Patton. And you tell us about their friendship, despite the fact that there were intriguing differences between them. And one thing I found quite interesting is Dwight D. Eisenhower's great sadness, great consternation that the First World War came to a close as quickly as it did, denying him, in a sense, the opportunity to go to Europe and to be part of that conflict. And of course, now it's a little bit hard to read those words and read of anybody being in any way sad that that horrific conflict had come to a close. But at least in that limited sense of his own professional well-being as an officer in the U.S. Army, it honestly was a source of disappointment for him that he could not be part of that conflict. On the other hand, it can be argued that because he was not part of that conflict, it made Eisenhower open to a different kind of warfare being waged, which, of course, is what the Second World War turned out to be.
No, that's absolutely true, is that it is that they being able to take a step back, that you weren't so having the unique experiences of trench warfare impressed upon you, that by not having been in the trenches, he was able to gain a much broader perspective. This also came about in two other ways, in that when he was eventually, in 1922, went to serve in Panama under Brigadier General Fox Connor. Fox Connor became very famously a mentor and taught him all about grand strategy and much of the lessons about how to think strategically, not just tactically. And he also taught him about the importance of alliance warfare, about having allies in warfare. And this is what made Eisenhower so uniquely well-suited to be Supreme Commander in Europe, was that he got along with everybody. He was the most likable officer of his generation. so that even officers who, foreign officers like Montgomery, who tended to dismiss his skills as a strategic commander, but they said, man, you liked him, and man, you wanted to do work with him and do well with him. Secondly, he also had an assignment in between the attending, finishing first in his class at the Command and General Staff School and going to the War College, where he served on the American Battlefield Monument Commission, which was basically writing a guidebook for American tourists going to France to see, who wanted to see where the Americans had fought, where the Americans had served. So he, working actually under a retired General Pershing, wrote what is still in print today, a guidebook to all the American battlefield monuments. And so he got to understand the entire history of the war from a broader perspective than he would have been if he had been a colonel in the tank corps, which is what he was about a week away from deploying as in November 1918.
Hmm. You also tell us, although we don't really have time to talk about it now, about the exploration he and Patton made in new ways to use the tank and innovations that could make the tank a more effective instrument of war. Can you just say a brief word about the significance of this?
Very briefly, they were ahead of their time in their ideas about tanks. They both commanded tank brigades at Camp Meade, Maryland. Eisenhower commanded heavy tanks, Patton the lighter tanks. And they did experiments, and they wrote articles about what they thought the future were that were literally on a par with European innovators such as Fuller and Guderian. But the army, basically, the infantry owned the tank corps. The infantry didn't want to change its doctrine of infantry supremacy and shut them down very hard. And it's part of a larger story of how, especially in the early years after World War I, the army clamped down and prevented any innovation, whether it was MacArthur trying to revolutionize education at West Point, Wisconsinite Billy Mitchell trying to revolutionize the use of air power, that they fell victim to the army's sort of traditional mindset.
I wonder if we can spend our last couple of minutes talking about the important work of then Brigadier General Douglas MacArthur. You tell us all kinds of great stories about Douglas MacArthur, but one of the most important chapters for him in terms of developing into who he was to become, and in a sense, the significant role he played in the renewal of the U.S. Army's well-being, shall we say, is when he was dispatched to West Point to take over as superintendent there. Explain why there was such trouble at West Point and what Douglas MacArthur was charged with doing there.
Well, MacArthur, West Point had become complacent. It had enjoyed such success in the Civil War as far as the commanders of, you know, Lee, Grant, Sherman, et cetera. They were all West Pointers, and they became so revered. And West Point genuinely was the birthplace of much of the great civil engineering in the United States, that they didn't see any need to sort of change with the times, and that education had become very much more modernized in the 70 years since. And in World War I, their West Point produced commanders, especially the junior officers, were often too rigid in their thinking. They were having a problem because West Point, they kept basically uprooting and graduating classes early, so the basic system of how the school's discipline worked got upended, that they had basically three different classes graduate in 1 year. There was a hazing death in early 1919 because there were no checks on sometimes very vicious hazing that was just considered part of toughening up and disciplining an officer. So they brought back one of the most brilliant graduates of West Point either. You know, love MacArthur, hate MacArthur. His academic record there and a record as a cadet leader was incredible. And he had a very ahead of his time, innovative vision for how to reform education at West Point. So it wouldn't be all rote memorization. It would include more usage of the social sciences and the humanities, that cadets would be trusted a little more. If they were going to be leaders of men in war, they should be allowed to manage a little bit more of their own affairs and discipline. And every innovation that he proposed was adopted, but just 20 years later, that the traditionalists still held the power, balance of power at West Point on the traditionalist academic board, the department chairs who had been there for 30, 40 years. And the alumni were still very traditionalist. And they could appeal to the chief of staff, John Pershing, who was a traditionalist, and eventually effectively relieved MacArthur of duty in 21 and exiled him to the Philippines in 22. So it was another case of, you know, MacArthur, when he was right, MacArthur was brilliant, and he was right about the need and how to reform West Point. And West Point today, the high points of it are reflections of MacArthur's vision. It just was, he was ahead of his time, and they weren't ready for him.
Right. And there is much more about all of these important figures in your book. We are just scratching the surface. The last thing I want to do in the last minute or so that remains is to have you talk about another facet of the book that might catch some people by surprise. And that is that although this is primarily a history book about this period between the two world wars, time and time again, you make very specific reference to the current day. Explain the parallel and why you think it is so significant to talk about the present as much as you do in this book, which at a glance would seem to be only about the past.
Well, I think there are two aspects to that, and I'll try and be as quick as possible with it, is that one, that in the wake of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's been a lot of criticism of the quality of American generalship. And whether these critiques are, where they're right, where they're wrong, regardless, I think there's general agreement that the quality of U.S. military leadership is important for our national security. So it's important to find ways of how to effectively develop leaders. And I think that the interwar era is a good analogy for a shrinking force, an increasingly isolationist public, difficulties with readiness and training, that I think it's a good way to teach how to leaders can be developed in challenging times. I also think, though, that there's an important lesson, and for not just young military officers today, but for a broader audience or for broader people, is that if you take a step back and you think about it, I think even though the book's a work of military history, it's also really the story of a group of middle-aged men toiling in what seemed to be like a dying profession. They earn lower salaries than their peers in other fields, and despite being talented, as you noted, their promotions just didn't come. They often went a decade without being promoted. During the Depression, they had to take pay cuts just to keep their jobs. And they also had, during these years, in addition to these professional frustrations, as you noted, again, many of them suffered personal tragedies, the death of children, the death of spouses, divorces, depression, PTSD. And so I think that, and yet despite all these obstacles, despite all these setbacks, when the world faced possibly its darkest hour, I mean, with fascism and barbarism, and that's not an overstatement, on the march across four continents, these men stood ready to lead America's young men in the fight for civilization. And I think there's a bigger story that can be told about this, to more than just military people as well, about the importance of resilience and the importance of being able to endure difficult times, to look ahead, to keep working, and to keep hope that that it'll pay off and that the moment will come when you get just rewards.
The book again is Generals in the Making, How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II, published by Stackpole Books, which is a division of Roman and Littlefield. The author, Benjamin Runkle. Benjamin Runkle, thank you so much for writing this fascinating and important book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I've enjoyed our conversation very much.
Me too. Thank you very much, Greg.
And to finish out today's morning show, I want to play for you a portion of a conversation I recorded back in 2013 with best-selling author Jean Edward Smith, an excerpt from our interview talking about his fascinating book, Eisenhower in War and Peace, published by Random House. In this portion of our conversation, we are talking about Eisenhower's experience at West Point, and Smith makes, among other remarkable points, the observation that Eisenhower might not have, in fact, managed to graduate from West Point if it not had been for his talents on the athletic field.
Well, Eisenhower looked at West Point a little bit like Grant and Pershing did. They went there for an education. Very much unlike the attitude of Douglas MacArthur and George Patton, who went in search of military glory. For Eisenhower, he and Grant, they could take the army or leave it at that point in their lives, and it was the athletics and the camaraderie that kept Ike at West Point, and he did very well. One of the curious things, Ike received a serious knee injury as he was playing football and couldn't play for the last 2 years that he was at West Point, but he became head cheerleader at West Point. Curiously, Franklin Roosevelt was head cheerleader at Harvard. Ronald Reagan was head cheerleader at Eureka College. And George W. Bush was head cheerleader at Andover. It's curious.
It sure is. In the chapter of your book called The Great War, in which we find out about Eisenhower's experiences during what we now call the First World War, one of the most interesting and insightful statements you make is the fact that Dwight D. Eisenhower missed seeing, in a sense, actual combat in the First World War. Didn't miss it by much, but essentially the war ended before he was actually out on the battlefield. You say that this, in fact, might have been of profound importance in terms of what kind of a general he was and how he led during the Second World War.
I think that's true. It's a little introverted argument, but the people who served in the trenches in World War I really understood it firsthand, the severity of the sacrifice and what was involved, and particularly among the British officers who saw much more of it, that made them very reluctant to risk men's lives unnecessarily. Not having seen that, I think Eisenhower looked at it somewhat more abstractly and was therefore able to commit troops to battle with less reluctance, perhaps, than if he had been in the trenches night after night after night in the First World War.
And haunted by those kind of images. You write, unlike many British senior commanders, Eisenhower had not been shocked into excessive caution by the futile slaughter of World War I. He was ready for a war of maneuver, and his early experience with America's nascent tank corps perhaps prepared him far better than a year in the trenches would have done.
I think that's correct. Eisenhower spent, as you mentioned, World War I at Gettysburg at the Army's Tank Training Center. He was the commander of that. He was graduated from West Point in 1915, and he was one of three members of his class who rose as high as the rank of lieutenant colonel. Only three of them did. And then after the war, he was reduced to the rank of major and stayed in that rank for 16 years. Promotions in the Army in those days were strictly by seniority, and Eisenhower's turn didn't come up until 16 years later. So he was for 16 years a major in the Army.
During the chapter called The Peacetime Army, where we chart his life between the world wars, this is where we learn some of the most interesting things about the marriage between Dwight D. Eisenhower and his wife, Mamie Dowd. And one facet of their marriage I don't remember hearing much about was the very sad death of their first son, which you say was an event that seems to have dramatically and perhaps permanently altered the chemistry between husband and wife.
I think so. I think each one secretly, in some respects, blamed the other. It was the child was named Ike. He was a little over three years old. He died of scarlet fever when Ike was stationed at Fort Meade in Maryland. And I think the marriage was never the same. Was never the same after that. They both took it very hard, particularly Eisenhower. And there was just nothing they could do. The medical profession was such at the time that there was just nothing that they could do to save the child. And that it was a traumatic moment for both of them.
Right. We should maybe mention that in charting their relationship, their marriage, and some of its difficulties, that you, in a sense, have only half of what you would want to have. That is, you have the letters that the one sent to the other, but not the other letters. And this is sort of an intriguing situation in and of itself.
That's correct. In the 1980s, when Kay Summersby published her second book called Past Forgetting, My Love Affair with Dwight D. Eisenhower, John Eisenhower, the president's son, then shortly after that, published a book called Letters to Mamie, which were Ike's letters to his wife during World War II. Strangely, Mamie's letters to Ike not only have never been published, but it's not exactly clear where they are. John says that they don't exist, and it's difficult to believe, but anyway, we certainly don't know of their existence at this point. But clearly, many of Ike's letters were written in reply to Mamie's letters to him, and for some reason, I have a feeling that that John may have felt it was best to dispose of those.
Hmm. As we chart those later years between the wars, among other things, you tell us that Dwight D. Eisenhower, in the wake of the stock market crash and the Great Depression, became caught up in the excitement of the New Deal. And it helps us understand that Eisenhower, at least in some respects, was a very complicated mix of philosophies. I mean, conservative in some ways, quite progressive in others.
That's right. But I think most importantly, Eisenhower was extremely intelligent and had the ability to grow as he was exposed to new situations. I think he began from a very, very conservative standpoint, as the professional army during the interwar years were. And during his time in Washington, I think changed considerably, and as he was exposed to new situations, as during World War II, as he was exposed to the British and the French, he changed a great deal, and he was able to mature. He was never wedded to ideas of a previous age.
Hmm. You write, as he saw more of the world, as he dealt with policy issues, he learned to appreciate a diversity of viewpoints and to value the intrinsic individuality of Western society. What set him apart from some of his regular Army contemporaries was Eisenhower's ability to absorb the lessons around him and broaden his outlook.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and I would stand by that paragraph forever.
Gene Edward Smith. His book is titled Eisenhower in War and Peace, published by Random House. That was an excerpt from a conversation I recorded with Mr. Smith back in 2013. Tomorrow on the morning show, I hope you can listen to my interview with Ryan Swanson, whose fascinating book is titled The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. Athletics was very important to Theodore Roosevelt, as some people know from their history. And Theodore Roosevelt not only cared about athletics for himself, for his own well-being, but also believed it was an important, maybe even intrinsic part of American life collectively, and a very important part of America's character. And he really helped to make athletics have a different presence on the American scene. And this book examines all of that and more. It's quite fascinating, and I hope that you will make a point of listening to tomorrow's morning show. On Thursday, Katie Madison will be with us to talk about Bell City Magazine, a lovely magazine that celebrates of the city of Racine. And on Friday, you'll hear about a upcoming American Experience documentary called The Feud, which explores the remarkable story of the feud between the McCoys and the Hatfields, a story that gripped the entire nation in the mid-19th century. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's archived on WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And the morning show can come to you as a podcast 7 days a week, available on all the major podcast platforms.